You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here and co-director of the Brookings LSE Project on Internal Displacement. We're delighted to organize this event together with Save the Children to talk about some of the long-term development and transitional challenges that Afghanistan faces today. And we've put together a distinguished panel of people who are going to speak from somewhat different perspectives about these challenges as we look toward Afghanistan's future. It's a lot of discussion about the military situation, security, the role of Afghan National Army and police forces, but we hope in this panel to complement some of those discussions by focusing on the strategic development and often governance challenges, as well as some of the implications for U.S. policy. Before doing so, however, I wanted to just say a few words about the present humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. Humanitarian being immediate life-saving assistance. Some of you may have seen the news this week about the bombing at the UNHCR office in Kandahar with the death of three humanitarian workers, a trend that we've seen over the course of the last year or even longer, where to do humanitarian work in Afghanistan is often very dangerous for international workers. If you look at issues around the movement of people, which is what my project focuses on, the first thing to say about Afghanistan has been the dramatic return of some 5 million refugees from outside the country since 2002. That represents some 20% of Afghanistan's population. Unfortunately, not all of the refugees, most of the refugees, have not been able to return to their communities of origin, although they've come back to the country, but we think that many of them have become, in effect, internally displaced persons. Certainly you see the swelling of Kabul, the capital city, probably as a result of many of these refugees being unable to go back to their homes for primarily security reasons, although there are also economic factors, as I'm sure we'll hear. In the past few months, there have been some disturbing reports from the UN in Afghanistan about the increasing number of internally displaced persons, people forced to leave their communities because of violence or security, who aren't able to cross an international border. The numbers are increasing, something like 480,000 today. But what's particularly disturbing is all the caveats that come along with these UN figures. We're 480,000 IDPs, but that doesn't count people who are living in cities or in semi-urban areas where most of the world's IDPs live, not in easily distinguishable camps. And it doesn't include those areas to which the UN does not have access for security reasons. I think over half of the country, the UN isn't able to travel freely in because of security reasons. And so those numbers may represent just a small percentage of a far larger number whose dimensions we simply don't know. We're worried, though, that as displacement drags on, as it becomes protracted, it's more difficult to find solutions for IDPs. And we've seen in many regions of the world that when displacement drags on, when people are away from their communities, when they're not able to get on with their lives, then in fact that can be a deterrent to the establishment of peace, security, stability in a country. That helping find solutions for IDPs or for refugees can in fact contribute to the process of peace building and stability securing in a place such as Afghanistan. So with those few comments, we're going to turn to our three distinguished speakers here. We're going to begin with David Skinner, who's been country director of Save the Children in Afghanistan for the past 2.5 years. Is that right, 2.5 years?
2.5 years. Mm-hmm.
Before that, if you look at his little bio here that we distributed, he's had quite a unique career. Usually when we have humanitarian workers, it's a long listing of different duty posts and different organizations, but David worked with the UK's national medical regulator, the General Medical Council, and was also involved in coordinating negotiations with the Chinese government over handing over of Hong Kong, which is a quite different career pattern than most people that we usually welcome for humanitarian issues anyway. Then we're going to turn to Kath Campbell, who works with USAID's Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan, really only since this year. Like other humanitarian or development actors, she does have a long experience of working with different organizations, NGOs in South Sudan, Uganda, Afghanistan, and so on. We'll then turn to Caroline Wadhams, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who's worked as a legislative assistant on foreign policy for Senator Feingold, also has worked with International Rescue Committee and other NGOs overseas, and is particularly going to talk about some of the consequences or implications, if you will, for U.S. policy. So we've asked each of them to speak for about 15 minutes. Please save your questions. I'm sure we'll have a lively debate afterwards. David.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. I've had the great privilege of being country director in Afghanistan, as we said, for 2.5 years. And I wanted to start off thinking about Afghanistan in a positive way. And it's very easy. I've just spent a couple of days talking to people around DC, and there's clearly fatigue with Afghanistan. There's clearly a sense of, is Afghanistan still there? And I just wanted to start off by reminding ourselves that Afghanistan is actually a fantastic country. It's a very beautiful country. It's a very stark, very rugged country. It's got a long and proud history. It's got it's had a lot of problems in its history as well. My Afghan colleagues and say the children's staff. We have about 1,000 staff in Afghanistan, all bar 15 are Afghans. Are a fantastic group of very dedicated, very concerned, very amusing people. An enormous privilege to work with them. And I also wanted to say a bit about the successes that have happened in Afghanistan over the last 10 years, because there have been some successes in Afghanistan, and we mustn't forget that. In 1970, the under 5 mortality rate was 1 in 3. By 2000, it had got to 1 in 4. The latest data that's been published is that it's 1 in 5. We now have 85% of Afghans have access to primary care. That was about 9% in 2000. Primary school enrollment has gone from 1 million to 7 million. I mean, that's a staggering increase. 2.5 million girls in school. Interesting, 28% of the Afghan parliament are female, which is better than both the British Parliament and the House of Representatives here. Well, I checked this morning, it's 17% of the House of Representatives are female. 2008, Afghanistan submitted its first report under the Convention of the Rights of the Child, showing that as a government it was taking its international obligations seriously and holding itself to account in the public forum, international public forum, serious treaty commitments to further the rights of children. All of that is good. All of that's impressive. I wanted also to give you a little bit of a sense of sort of more intimate changes in Afghanistan over the last few years, so to give you a tenor of life in Afghanistan. How many of you have been in Afghanistan? That would actually be helpful to know. So quite lots of you have been to Afghanistan. So some of this you'll recognize. But some things. Outside our offices, Save the Children's compound in Darulaman Road, we now have street lamps, which is fantastic. Most of the time, the street lamps are working as well, so that's good. But seriously, the quality and the quantity of electricity coming into Kabul over the last 2.5 years has improved enormously. I don't have to change my transformers on my computer nearly as often as I used to. Mobile telephone coverage. Right the way across, and a penetration of mobile telephones, which is fantastic. I mean, you'll see guys working on the road suddenly stopping and pulling a telephone out of their clothing and talking on the telephone. So these guys are some of the least well-paid people in the world, I guess. But they have access to a piece of liberating technology, which I think is important. Television. Those of you who have lived in Afghanistan will know what the most popular television show in Afghanistan is. It's Starry Afghan, Afghan Idol. So Afghan Idol is, and it's great. For those of you who haven't seen it, strongly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. The cricket gets quite a lot of coverage, but actually it's the television serials, the Turkish television serials, which talk to the staff over lunch in the office. That's what they're talking about. I mean, that's interesting because it's giving a different perception of the world, a perception of the world where women are not wearing scarves or veiled, where women are driving cars, where they're holding senior and important roles and things, and in a modern Islamic country or culturally Islamic country. And so that, I think, is interesting. And you sort of see those kinds of cultural changes coming through. And I wish I could say that had something to do with Save the Children. Of course, it doesn't. I mean, those are sort of deep cultural changes, which are really very, very important. So that's, if you like, the good news. But there's also quite a lot of less good news. And if you are a girl born in Afghanistan at the moment, you've got a pretty tough life. I've already said that 1 in 5 children don't survive beyond their 5th birthday. That's the second worst rate in the world at the moment. It's very, very difficult. If that rate were to be doubled, so improved twice, so it became 1 in 10, that rate would still be worse than pre-earthquake Haiti. So it's tough. And then if you're a boy and you get to 5 or 6, basically you're going to be all right. But if you're a girl, remember that the maternal mortality rate in Afghanistan is 1 in 11. That means for every 11 live births, a woman dies in childbirth. The equivalent figure for the US is 2,500. That's not a good figure, incidentally. The figures for the UK are about 4,000, and the figures for Singapore are 10,000. So, but in Afghanistan, 1 in 11. And remember that in Afghanistan, 57% of all girls are married by the time they're 16. 57% of all girls are married by the time they're 16. So many of the females who are dying in childbirth are themselves children. When you get married in Afghanistan, you have children. And many of the Afghan girls who are pregnant, giving birth, their bodies are not ready to give birth in quite that way. It's tough. There's been a great deal of success in terms of education, but Afghanistan still has the worst primary enrollment rates, sorry, the gender disparity rates at primary school in the world. So 40% of girls are going to primary school, 60% of boys. That's the worst rate in the world, I'm afraid. And in some provinces, it's even worse. In Zabul or in Uruzgan, the rate is 1 to 10. So one girl is going to primary school for every 10 boys who are going to primary school. Ministry of Education says that 50% of all education activity is taking place in a tent or outside. Why? Why in the last 10 years we haven't managed to build the schools as an international community? I simply don't know. But it is the case that at the moment, and this is not, and I'm not talking about the difficulty of building schools in very insecure areas, which are real issues. I'm talking about schools in some of the most secure areas in Afghanistan. If you go to Bamiyan, where the Buddhas were, it's about the safest place in Afghanistan. I can walk down the street. I can go for a run around the airport, and it's great visiting Bamiyan. You sort of get a sense of freedom. But the boys' lycée there, big lycée in the middle of Bamiyan, is surrounded by tents. It was designed for 1,500 boys. There are 3,000 boys attending. The provision simply hasn't been made. Female literacy. is very low. In Uruzgan province, where Save the Children does a lot of work, it's right in the middle of Afghanistan, the female literacy rate is 3 in 1,000, meaning that 3 women out of every 1,000 have had the opportunity to go to school to learn to read. So that's quite a figure. And that's interesting. It picks up on what you were saying about the refugees. Uruzgan is is right in the middle of Afghanistan, and it was a province which didn't have refugees. So it didn't have people who went down the mountains into Pakistan or over the border into Iran, and so hasn't benefited from the education and the health practices that refugees picked up in the camps in Pakistan or Iran. That's quite an interesting challenge for us. And again, picking up on what you were saying about refugees or displaced people in the urbanized area, it's a really interesting and large issue. 37,000 children in Kabul are working on the streets. 37,000, that's a very large number. And they're doing it, they're living with their families. And one very strong point about Afghanistan is that the number of children who are not living with their extended family is very small compared to many other countries. But they're working, and they're working for economic reasons. They need to, their families need them to go out and earn typically about $1 a day in various activities that they're undertaking. So there have been some successes, but there's still a very long way to go. And if you look back, over the last 10 years, look back to September 2000. So September 2000, what happened in September 2000? September 2000, you had what was certainly then, and I think may still be, the world's largest ever gathering of heads of state at the Millennium Summit, where the world committed to meeting the Millennium Development Goals. There's somebody outside. Your hearing gets very acute when you're in Afghanistan. You're listening for things all the time. So the Millennium Development Summit, the Millennium Development Goals, and they committed the world to meet these goals. Now, essentially, money has not been a limiting factor in Afghanistan over the last 10 years. We know that. I mean, there's been a lot of money that's gone to Afghanistan. How many of the Millennium Development Goals are going to be met in Afghanistan by 2015? None. None are going to be met. So there's been money that's gone into Afghanistan, but we're not hitting it. Why is that? Why do I think that's the case? I think there's a number of reasons for it. One is I think that an awful lot of the development assistance has been used, the allocation of the development assistance has been allocated on the basis of security imperatives or security requirements instead of development requirements. Now, I've been saying I'm in no position at all to say whether it's been successful in security terms. It's not my area of expertise. I couldn't tell you if spending the money in the way that it has been spent has resulted in security objectives being met. I do know that it has not resulted in development objectives being met, and it has distorted the way that funding has happened. In fiscal 2009-2010, 77% of the US government's funding in Afghanistan went to the south and east. Now, if you look at some of the provinces in the south, Kandahar is a good example. The poverty rates in Kandahar are quite high, but they're 30%. They're just about 30% in Kandahar. And Kandahar has received a lot of assistance. If you look at somewhere like Bamiyan, as I was talking about earlier, they've got poverty rates in Bamiyan at about 60%. And is receiving much less overseas assistance. So, as a development agency, we would argue very strongly that development assistance should be predicated on development needs, and that hasn't always been the case in Afghanistan. I've got a quote from the recent report from the Foreign Relations Committee. Constant demand for immediate results prevented the implementation of programs that could have met long-term goals and would now be bearing fruit. And I think there is some truth in that. I mean, I think there's been a tendency to try to have short, quick wins in order to get some immediate results without thinking through the long-term strategic engagement. Money has been spent badly. There's been malfeasance, there's been incompetence. There's been, as those of you who've worked in Afghanistan know, those of you who've read about Afghanistan, it's the corruption in Afghanistan is corrosive, top to bottom, and it's a constant reality in working in Afghanistan. But, I mean, again, European Parliament report recently, most of the wasted money is not due to, is not a consequence of the Afghan government, due to corruption in the Afghan government, but is due to waste, duplication, over-invoicing, excessive and unnecessary expenses for consultancy and security. I think it's probably important to say that that's quite a European perspective. And one of the things that I can say as country director who takes money from a variety of different sources, about 40% of our funding is US government funding, and the balance, 60%, is other donors. The scrutiny of US government funding is far more rigorous than the scrutiny of funding from other donors. And that's a really important point to make. And I, as country director, value the fact that that the US government is so hot on checking on where all the dollars go, because it does mean that the grants are delivered that much more effectively. Julio and I worked together on a teacher training program in the north of Afghanistan, and I think we can say that the US government funding which was allocated for that was spent absolutely appropriately on teacher training in the north. And that's partly because of the scrutiny that was being provided. I've only got 2 minutes, and I've got vast numbers of things to say, of course. I mean, you know, I can speak about Afghanistan for forever. The most important point that I want to make is that I think that Afghanistan is at an inflection point. I think that... And it's not an inflection point because of the transition. It's not an inflection point because of the elections. It's not an inflection point because of the withdrawal of international troops. I think it's a much more interesting inflection point. It's an inflection point where we are ready to be able to capitalize on the investment that we have made in Afghanistan over the last 10 years. One example, we are now beginning to see the girls who were going back to school or going to school for the first time 2001, 2002, graduating from school. Next 2 or 3 years, we're going to be seeing a fairly large number of educated Afghan women coming into the labor market. And what are they going to do? They're going to be teachers. They're going to be midwives. They're going to be nurses. And that is going to set off, I hope and trust, a virtuous cycle. Why do girls not go to school at the moment? Because there are not enough female teachers, amongst other things, but that's very often a limiting factor. Why is it that so many women are dying in childbirth? Because there are not trained birth attendants. We now have in Afghanistan a real possibility for taking advantage of the work that we've done in the last 10 years. So the absolutely key point that I wanted to get over this afternoon is that now is not the time to take our eye off the ball in terms of development in Afghanistan. Now is the time absolutely to stay the course and to support the Afghan women and the Afghan children who otherwise would not get their education, would not be able to live a long and healthy life. So we've got to keep working in Afghanistan on key issues of this sort.
Thank you very much. And you will have a chance in responding to questions to cover some of your other many points.
They're very good points, incidentally. So please do.
Okay, we'll turn now to Kath Campbell from USAID to talk about Afghanistan.
Thanks. I'm glad David went first because I think he has helped us. I think he's made it really clear that we face a lot of challenges. But it's really important for us to look back to where we were 10 years ago and understand that we really have, and Afghanistan, I should say, has made huge progress. And knowing that, it should give us some, you know, inspiration and commitment to stay the course, as David has said, because we really do face some big challenges going forward, and they're going to be different types of challenges than we've faced in the past. Some of them will be the same, like security, probably, but there's other things that are going to happen. And I think, I guess I feel like now in Afghanistan, we've really got this challenge of getting Afghanistan on the right trajectory for sustainability of the economy, for sustainability of the society, for sustainability in governance issues. And we've been relying on aid, high aid levels in the past to do that. And these are not sustainable. We all know that. I think that's pretty much accepted. So the government is going to have to come up with a way to raise revenue. And to do that, it is going to have to be supportive of an inclusive, an equitable economic growth. We need to see the government fostering and then maintaining an enabling environment for that type of growth. And it's got to be able to have the ability to provide these services, to fund these services, the infrastructure, et cetera, that some of which, a lot of which is now in place. And it's also going to need a society that can hold that government accountable for those tasks and has the capacity and the health and the education, the skills to engage and create that economy. So those are, that's a great sort of agenda to have. We have a lot of different challenges that are going to confront that, security not being the least, humanitarian concerns, the exogenous sort of shocks that Afghanistan could face, like drought, could really throw that off track. Not to mention, you know, yes, the food security and the humanitarian side of that, but the importance of agriculture at some 85% of the population relies on agriculture for their subsistence in one way or another. If there's a drought, the entire economy is impacted. The local traders, the people, the government revenues from exports go down. So this is a huge challenge that we will undoubtedly face in the next few years, if not immediately. But the transition to security lead, which you've all been, I'm sure, reading about and hearing about, also really raises two other key challenges. One is the economic impact of the military drawdown, and the other is the likely decrease in foreign assistance overall, both military and civilian, in the wake of that military drawdown. The World Bank is going to be releasing a big report, hopefully this month, that will really explore and tease out the impact of those two events or those two likely sort of challenges that it will have on poverty in Afghanistan, on the fiscal sustainability in Afghanistan, and that's going to be very helpful. But we already know that the impact is going to be big. Afghanistan has had quite remarkable growth over the past 10 years, about 8 or 9% on average. And they are estimating that growth rate will go down to maybe 5% annual growth, maybe 2%, maybe even no growth at all for the next few years, all because of the impact of the military not spending its money there, not doing as much assistance, and what they think is the likely decline in foreign assistance. So that's all quite sobering. But there are some things we can do, the international community can do, we can all do to try and address that thing and help Afghanistan sort of get on or stay on the trajectory that it's on now. One of them is for us to think about how we can really best support the government of Afghanistan in leading the prioritization and supporting them to make the policy reforms that are needed. Those are both really critical. Afghanistan's already laid out its priorities. It has an Afghan National Development Strategy. It has national priority programs that it laid out last year, and it's further refining now. But with decreases in aid, they're probably going to have to make more choices about what gets funded first and what we can wait on And those are going to be really difficult. Is it funding community health workers? Or is it funding, you know, a dam that will help for irrigation and agriculture and also power up the street lamps in Kabul or the hospital or the Ministry of Public Health? Those are really, you know, those are tough choices that they're going to have to make, and we're all going to have to make. And there aren't any really obvious answers about which one goes first. And there are tensions between producing results quickly and producing the capacity to lead and to fund in the future and to manage and sustain the services and the infrastructure. So those are just, those are real tensions. And the government has also made clear its commitment to an economic growth that is driven by the private sector. But that's going to require a lot of policy reforms that are really challenging to make, even with the best of will. There's a lot of vested interests in Afghanistan and everywhere that don't want to see those reforms. And they just take a lot of political and human capacity to make those happen. So we all need to be really thinking about how we can support them and incentivize the government to do that. We're looking forward to Bonn conference in early December to hear from the government of Afghanistan so that we can and start, you know, really supporting them and aligning with them a bit further. One of the other things that we can think about is how do we increase the local content of our assistance? And, you know, in trying to figure out what the economic impact was going to be of the decreasing military presence and possible declines in assistance, it was a real struggle to figure out how much of our money or the international community's money actually gets spent in Afghanistan. And there have been some estimates, and more will come out. I think the World Bank is trying to come up with an estimate. Some estimates put the local content of off-budget development assistance at as low as 20%, which isn't great. And it won't surprise you to hear that money that is spent on budget and through local systems is quite a bit more, 70%, 80%, depends, you know, where you're spending it on what and whether they're having to import things, et cetera. But so, you know, quite apart from the arguments about spending more money through the local systems, increasing local ownership, building local capacity, helping with increased alignment, increasing cost effectiveness, we are now, you know, really understanding that increasing the local content and the use of local systems can also be a really important tool to mitigating the impact on the economy and on the people of Afghanistan of these drawdowns in both military presence and assistance. So that's something that we're really trying to think about and move forward on. Another area that we need to think about and I think really consider carefully is how do we make sure that Afghanistan's natural resources help Afghanistan get on this sustainable trajectory and don't turn into a curse, the natural resource curse that we've all heard about. We've heard that there's $1 trillion in the ground. I've even heard $3 trillion. I think that's somebody's typo, but the important thing to think about that number and those minerals is that they're in the ground for a reason. It's because there hasn't been the security or the transport or the skills or the rule of law or the land rights or whatever that's been necessary to get them out of the ground. That's changing slowly. The other thing to remember is that $1 trillion doesn't just automatically get pocketed by the government of Afghanistan to go pay off its troops and its health care and its education. That number is sort of, it represents, you know, if that money could just sort of magically go out into the market, if the minerals could be sold immediately on the market. The Afghan government will get a fraction of that $1 trillion. But it'll still be significant, and significant enough to really be a huge assistance if it can be managed properly. The other thing that the mining industry promises is the development of businesses and commerce around the mines and on the corridors leading to the mines. But that also really needs to be managed carefully. There's huge variables, huge risks involved. And so we've really got to think carefully about how Afghanistan manages these things, how they negotiate these things. And Afghanistan is trying to make all the right moves. They've signed up to the EITI initiative, which is a transparency initiative. You can actually see the contracts for the recent mines on their ministry website. It's quite interesting, actually. But EITI, this initiative, relies on transparency to get civil society to hold the government accountable, to hold these companies accountable, etc. And as we know, civil society in Afghanistan is thinly stretched, let's say. So we need to think about that, and we also need to think about the fact that EITI doesn't actually help ensure that the state does a good job negotiating with these companies, that it figures out, you know, what's the best deal for our country vis-a-vis these companies. How do we want to structure the deal so that we get a steady income going forward? These are things that are really challenging, and I don't pretend to be an expert on that. And donors are helping the ministry try and build its capacity to manage some of this stuff, but there is enormous pressure on Afghanistan because of the drawdown, because of the likely decline in assistance, for them to get these minerals out on the market, to get these concessions sold off. So we need to remain very engaged. For NGOs working on the ground, I would say, you know, if you're working with communities, get them to follow the money and think about what possible mineral resources are going to be sold away, possibly without them realizing. This information is available, but it won't stay available if there isn't a demand for it. So I think that's something we all need to really think about. Uh-oh, she's writing her two-minute warning. So one last concluding thought, and it really dovetails, I think, exactly with David, and I didn't even talk to him beforehand, so. But it's, how do we have gradual, predictable declines in assistance? And anybody, as you probably all do, following foreign assistance in America knows that that's a huge challenge. But it's really clear if you look at other post-conflict societies where foreign militaries have withdrawn that the aid drops off very quickly once the militaries have left. And where the state is sufficiently sort of cohesive and consolidated, sometimes that transition can be handled relatively smoothly. But in cases where there's still a lot of lack of cohesiveness, maybe where there's still, you know, millions of IDPs and refugees and returnees who haven't settled, where we know there's still conflict, this type of thing can lead to, you know, to state collapse. And we don't need to look further than Afghanistan to know that that's happened before. Somalia is the other horrible, you know, example. And I'm not saying that that's going to happen here, but it really is important that we manage the drawdown of this aid both in a predictable fashion and in a gradual fashion. And that, needless to say, is going to be a huge challenge for us. There are many people in the community here, in government, who think we gave Afghanistan too much money. Maybe we did. Who think that it's taken away from other developing countries. Certainly did, but if we immediately overcorrect, we are risking to lose really all the progress I think that we've made. So it's just something to really think about: is how do we work with the entire international community to try and get that to be, you know, more of a gradual glide path rather than, you know, this dropping off a cliff. So that's it.
Well, thank you very much. It's a nice image to end on, dropping off a cliff. We'll turn now to Caroline.
Great, thank you, and thanks so much for having me. Thanks to all of you for coming. I'm going to talk a little bit at the sort of bigger picture, even out beyond above just the development picture, at sort of the larger U.S. policy and some of the security, governance, and economic challenges. I mean, I think what we all feel sort of is going to be the state of affairs, at least for the next few years, if not beyond, which makes it very difficult to predict how development can occur, is this sense of uncertainty. I was in Afghanistan during the summer and meeting with lots of civil society and political opposition, and the sense, and I'm sure you're picking up on this as well, but the fear expressed by many Afghans was palpable, just a sense of, you know, where is our country going? You're abandoning us. We're going to be a narco-terrorist state. We're going to civil war. Just this fear that was that we were constantly hearing. And I think that there's just a real sense of uncertainty. And what I'm going to basically talk about what I see is sort of three transitions that are occurring simultaneously right now and will occur over the next few years. There is the official NATO transition, INTICAL, which if you look actually deeply at what that is, there's very little content at that in that transition. There is a security handover, but it's largely there's no content to it. Nothing much is actually changing on the ground. It's sort of a symbolic transfer to Afghan leadership. And especially on the civilian side and the economic side, there is very, very little content. You don't know necessarily what happens with the provincial reconstruction teams. Nothing really changes in terms of who's governing a certain area or who has control over budgets. I mean, nothing is really changing in this in the official transition. But I do believe that there are three transitions happening. The first is that there is the military drawdown. And it's real, and it's happening. And we met with General Allen this summer. He was still at that point trying to figure out where they were going to draw down the troops from. But there was an order, and those troops had to come out. And he was trying to figure out what the plan was, where they were going to get those 10,000. The 33,000 troops will come out by September 2012. There will be 66,000 troops remaining in country, and we've already heard discussions in the press that there are now the administration is asking for plans on what the drawdown will look beyond those surge of troops which will come out. So I very much think that this is happening, that the withdrawal is very, very real, and clearly that will have large impacts on, I mean, first of all, the security, but then also there's a, I think, just the sense of it feeds certain perceptions, and about, you know, who's the winner, who's the loser, who do you side with, which could be potentially destabilizing. I think that beyond 2014, we just don't know what that troop presence will look like, and I think a lot of it will be determined by the Strategic Partnership Agreement, which is being negotiated right now, and then the subsequent SOFA, Strategic Forces Agreement, Status of Forces Agreement document after that, which will then determine the troop levels. But a lot of it will be up for debate, and I think you have a number of other countries like Pakistan and Iran who are resistant to a long-term, and China and Russia resistant to a long-term military presence. So I don't think we really know what that troop presence beyond 2014 is going to look like. And we don't really have a sense beyond this initial withdrawal of troops through September of 33,000. We don't know we don't know how fast the withdrawal will be beyond that. So real uncertainty. The second transition I see is this financial drawdown, which Kath referred to. I think it's pretty clear that some of the financial, the development assistance will draw down. What will also happen is that so much of the military contracts, the logistics contracts, the just protection for convoys that are associated with the military footprint, those are going to decline. And so what I think is probably most interesting to try to think through is how will that affect the political economy questions? There have been a lot of people who have gotten quite rich, a lot of Afghans who have gotten quite rich through these protecting convoys. For example, Mayatullah Khan, for example, in Uruzgan, or Commander Razik in Kandahar. What happens when some of those contracts dry up, and where do they seek alternative sources of funding? How does that change who has power in those in certain communities? So the World Bank report that Kath referred to, I think what has been interesting, I've just sort of heard initial reports about that. They don't, it seems thus far from the research, they don't see a huge, they were concerned, I think, when they initially went into the research that there was going to be basically a recession that was going to be, would be the result of the financial drawdown. What they found is that probably because of the low multiplier effect, the low local content of U.S. assistance and international assistance, it's actually not going to be as significant on the economic growth. But where it will have impact is on the political economy questions, and how does that change patronage and corruption and all of that. And then I also think with the financial drawdown, I mean, if you think about the Afghan National Security Forces, which they're estimating will cost about, you know, $5 or $6 billion per year indefinitely beyond 2014, I think there is a real fear that requirement crowds out all the other needs. So you're just not going to have as much development assistance for the infrastructure building, because $5 to $6 billion. Per year, that's a lot to ask the U.S. taxpayer or anybody else, and to add on top of that is going to be difficult to sustain politically. I think the third and final transition I see is the political transition, which again, so we're seeing military drawdown, the economic drawdown, and then a political transition, all of which are sort of exacerbating the uncertainty. And in the political transition, it's really just that in 2014, when Afghans are supposed to be in the lead of their security, is also when there is a presidential election. President Karzai, by the Constitution, according to the Constitution, is supposed to hand power over to another legitimately elected Afghan leader. Given the 2009 elections for president and the 2010 parliamentary elections, which were hugely problematic, fraud and all of the rest, exclusion of major different groups, there is a real fear that this election has the potential to ignite further violence. There does not appear, looking at this from the outside, there does not appear to be a lot of political will by the Afghan government or, frankly, by the international community to push for major electoral reform that would make the elections better, to push for some of the political reform that would get at the grievances that is driving some parts of the insurgency. So there is there's going to be a real political problem. We're facing it now, but if there's another election again like we've seen in 2014 or even 2013, there's supposed to be provincial council elections, this could be quite dangerous. I think what we're – so beyond these transitions, I think what I'm seeing when I'm sort of talking to U.S. government officials and people in the Obama administration, and you see this also in the press, is that there is a widespread recognition that the status quo in Afghanistan and the current strategy, training Afghan national security forces, weakening the insurgency through military force, that is not going to get us to a sustainable outcome in 2014 or beyond. And you see now, I think, the administration making a shift and basically recognizing that the ANSF is not going to be strong enough by 2014 and the insurgency is not going to be weak enough for there to be a match there. There is such a mismatch in these things that there's got to be another way to get to peace. And so the way that they're now looking at it is a much, much greater emphasis on a political settlement. And it's very much in the initial stages, and so it's very difficult to predict whether there it has the ability to have any legs, but that will clearly be a determinant of whether there is long-term security, because, I mean, my sense, and I think what the administration sees, is that we're not going to get there from here. This is where we are now. Even if the institutions are a little bit stronger, the ANSF is a little bigger, it's not going to be a peaceful outcome. So what you see with the administration is now they're doing a greater push on Pakistan, basically saying, okay, guys, you don't have to conduct full military operations in North Waziristan, but at least bring the, you know, Haqqani network and others to the negotiating table so we can start figuring out how to accommodate these different interests. It's too early to tell, and then you see again the administration also trying to get more regional buy-in through the Silk Road Initiative, trying to create this sort of positive incentives for different countries not to spoil Afghanistan, not to spoil whatever is created. So you see a shift, and I think we don't know yet where that's going. But clearly it makes it almost impossible to predict where we'll be in a few years. But, I mean, the trajectory right now is not, I don't think, a positive one. Hopefully there can be some good movement towards some kind of settlement at the local level or nationally, but we just don't know. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all three of you. I think your presentations complemented each other quite well. We have about 34 minutes for questions and comments, and if it's okay, we'll take several at a time and then give you a chance to respond. So we'll start with this one, two, three. We'll stay on the aisle, and there's, if you could identify yourself, please.
Hi, Len Rubenstein from Johns Hopkins. This is a question for Kath. I'd like to understand exactly what U.S. policy is on the drawdown, and I want to focus on health, because in health we've had enormous progress. It's never was anticipated that the money spent would be sustainable by the Afghan government when this was initiated. And we also know that in fragile states, everybody says you can't have the money leave when the war ends. So what is the plan of the administration with respect to continued funding rather than that's more specific than saying there'll be a drawdown?
Thank you. That's an easy question you can think about as we move to this woman here. Just wait for the microphone.
Thanks. Yeah, do we identify ourselves?
Yes.
Okay, Andre Berniski, also a colleague from Save the Children. As somebody who spent time in the neighboring country, Tajikistan, and so I'm a little familiar with Afghan issues from the perspective of a neighbor, and also 5 years in Colombia, I'm really interested in the impact and the dynamics of the drug trade on the insurgency and what kind of impacts that's going to have on the prospects for stability in Afghanistan.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. And my question is, seeing we're negotiating with the insurgents, the Taliban, et cetera, and they're likely to have considerable influence once we withdraw, what interest do they have in the development? What parts of it are they likely to support? I don't think they'll support the education of women, but beside that, what would they support?
Thank you. And we'll take this gentleman here, and then we'll have a chance for a response.
Thank you. My name is Mohammed Ahmadi. I'm working for Voice of America. Actually, I'm hosting the economic and reconstruction programs for Voice of America for Afghanistan. And I just want to know that one of the major concerns for Afghan people are the functioning of the NGOs in the country. We just want to talk about specifically about the 10 years past, that the portion of funds that the NGOs received, Afghan people mostly believe that are not spent in the right or path because most of them they spend in their own expenses. only small or tiny portion of the amount spent for the reconstruction or their projects. Now, I want to just know one of your gentlemen, particularly Mr. David, that was working as NGOs, Save the Children, that what is your evaluation of the functioning NGOs in Afghanistan? Thank you, sir.
Okay, it's a lot of questions. Would you like to start, Kath, with the question on U.S. policy? Or any other questions you want to address?
Well, I'm not going to tell you what the U.S. policy is on the drawdown, because that's not really something I'm comfortable talking about. But I can tell you, I mean, very generally, I guess your question is, what about the sustainability of the health system that we have been a large part of setting up? I think one answer is that they are exploring the Ministry of Health is seen as a very inspiring example of a place where we started 10 years ago, building their capacity from the get-go, and they are actually managing this health system now. They are managing the health system that's reaching 87%, I think you said, people have access to the primary health care. And they're, you know, managing international NGO contracts, et cetera. How are they going to continue funding that? Well, I mean, I think one answer is that eventually they're probably hoping they won't have to fund international NGOs, that they'll have these girls who are graduating from high school now who will become nurses, et cetera. I also know that they are exploring ways to get some sort of cost recovery. And, you know, I don't think that there's likely to be a full cost recovery in Afghanistan going forward for quite some time. But it is something that they're trying to explore. The other issue, and this is why I said, you know, the Afghan government really and the international community really has to think about it, is we're going to have to prioritize. And while there is clearly a need for, you know, more hospitals and more students and more school buildings, there's also a need for all the schools and the primary health care clinics to be maintained and operated and wages paid. So those, you know, we're going to have to make some of those really difficult choices. And you know, the money, the U.S. government, USAID's budget has already gone down from last year. So, you know, These are discussions that have to be, I think, led by the Ministry of Health, led by the Afghan government. But they are things that we're talking about a lot. And the other, sort of in a bigger picture, that's kind of what I was saying. The primary challenge, or at least one of the key challenges, is how to get the Afghan government's revenue up. Now, their revenue has been increasing quite significantly from zero, essentially, or from very, very low 10 years ago. But there's a lot more that needs to be done to have that revenue continue to go up. They have to create a better environment so that there is more private sector activity in the country. They need to do more trade, et cetera. They need to develop the mineral resources. All of these things can help contribute to an increased revenue flow to the Afghan government. But make no mistake, it's going to be a real challenge.
Thank you. We have questions on drugs, on the Taliban and development, and on NGOs, and what percentage of the funds is going to the people. Who would like to start?
I mean, I can talk a little bit about the drugs, but I think most of these are really directed towards you and Kath. I mean, just in terms of the drug trade, I mean, my sense is that the drug trade, yes, is fueling the insurgency, but it's also fueling the corruption in the government side. I mean, the drug trade is benefiting all sorts of actors within Afghanistan, and is, I mean, my sense is the Afghan government is as complicit in that as the insurgency is. There has been a shift by the Obama administration the way that it's dealing with it. It's not as doing as much eradication of the poppy on the farm, and trying to do the interdiction of the high level and the laboratories, which I think has been the right shift. But it's so pervasive. So I think I'll just leave it there.
I'll pick up on the on the negotiation of the Taliban point and the NGO point. But before that, I wanted to just think about the drawdown in funding. And Professor Rutherford, who got the Nobel Prize for splitting the atom, did his research in New Zealand, as many of you may know. And New Zealand is not famous for having large amounts of research funding. And he has scrawled on his wall a point which I've got scrawled on my wall in Afghanistan. And it's, if we don't have the money, we'll just have to think. And I think that's something which we're going to have to do in Afghanistan. As the funding comes down, it will force us to be more creative and to be more focused. And I think that's something which will be a good discipline for all of us. Negotiating with the Taliban, what interests do the Taliban have in development? It's very interesting. I mean, if I were to be the advisor to the Taliban in the negotiator, if I was sort of sitting in the Quetta Shura and they say, David, you know, what's the one thing that we could do to increase our position? I would say, stand up and say, we support girls' education. Because I think the minute that they do that, then all sorts of issues would change. And I think that what we find working in the communities is that there are very, very, very few Afghan parents who don't want health facilities for their children and who don't want education for their children. Now, they want education for their girls in certain circumstances. They don't want their daughters to walk for 2 hours to a misogynistic countryside to get to school. I don't want my daughter to walk for 2 hours to a misogynistic countryside to go to school. They want there to be female teachers. They want there to be latrines at the school. They want the schools to be close. And I think that communities value education. They value health. And the Taliban, at the end, has a political need to be supported in the communities. So I actually believe that for many of the basic social services, those will continue. And I think it's a different kind of situation than we were in 10, 12 years ago. Maybe I'm being naively optimistic, but I do believe that. Your point about NGOs. I think number of points there. First of all, organisations like Save the Children are bringing funding into Afghanistan, which would not otherwise be coming. So each year at the moment, there is $1 million coming in from child sponsorship programmes, which are where individuals around the world are putting their own money into Save the Children. That then $1 million a year is coming into Afghanistan. Our annual budget is about $45 million, to give you a perspective on this. At the moment as well, about $2 million a year is coming in from a corporate sponsorship we have with Bulgari, the jewellers. It's fantastic going into the Bulgari shops as country director for Afghanistan, because it's all part of their corporate campaign, and it's great walking in. So it's the only time I've ever been into a Bulgari shop, but it's a... Sorry. International NGOs such as Save the Children and others as well are mobilizing resources which come into Afghanistan, and the money that is mobilized in that way is often very interesting money, because it's money that we can use on innovative projects. It's money that we can we work with the government to look at where there are gaps and we try to build that. In terms of the government grants, NGOs, international NGOs, I think are pretty good value for money. I would say that, but I mean, I do. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is that we have very few international staff. As I said, there are 1,000, staff working for Save the Children in Afghanistan. 15 of those are international. The others are all Afghans, and so that funding all stays in Afghanistan. Some of my salary does go to pay for my wife and my children. I admit that, but the vast majority of that funding stays in Afghanistan. And the other point about international NGOs as well is that we don't use security companies. So we're not spending a lot of money on security because all of our activities is done through acceptance. So if the Afghan communities we're working in want us to be there, we're there. If they don't want us to be there, we're not. And we don't have armed guards. We don't have security services. And that's right the way across, even in places like Kandahar and Uruzgan, which is very difficult, very, very difficult in a security environment. So I would say that international NGOs are actually pretty good value for money, and I would think that the amount of money that leaves Afghanistan, me paying for my children, is more than offset, actually, by the money that we mobilize from outside of Afghanistan to bring in.
Thank you. Let's take another round of questions. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. And then we'll move toward the back.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the presentation. It's very informative. My name is Saeed. I'm from the Embassy of Afghanistan. I have a question about the NGOs and also about the Afghan National Army or Afghan National Security Forces. I think they are pretty much new about the Afghan National Security Forces. We start building the Afghan National Security Force at the end of 2008. And we are basically just kind of like trying to put them in a more practice and make them operational and put them alongside the national, the coalition forces and the NATO forces. Every time that we see, for example, the casualties that the NATO forces or the coalition force sustains, there are 1, 2, 3 of Afghan national security forces too. And also, we shouldn't forget that we are aiming for a pretty large army that's going to face largely 30,000 insurgents. The number of the Taliban's are not greater than the number of the national police or the national security forces. If they are capable with the equipment that they are right now, and if the training will continue as they are right now, I'm sure they are going to be capable of like fighting the insurgents. They are not a conventional force, the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda. They are just small groups. I'm sure they are going to be able to take it, hopefully. That's what we are hopeful about. But one question about the NGO, that right now we have basically rented houses for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, even $100,000. And we are actually paying Afghans who used to work, for example, for the Ministry of Education, Ministry of Higher Education, taught in the medical universities or Kabul universities or any other universities, basically encourage them and attract them towards the NGOs and paying them lots of money. Basically, compared to, for example, I used to work with American forces when I was in Afghanistan. I made more than a medical professor, literally. I mean, like, of course, now those people are no longer working for the government. And the government is basically in the hand of a bunch of people that basically they can't get job at the NGO. I'm sure Mr. David receives hundreds of resumes in a day. There's an NGO, it's called Akbar, they are collecting resumes. If you, you go there, there's a line of educated people, young educated people that are waiting to get a job. They sometimes stay unemployed for 6 months or a year to just get a job in NGO rather than going to work for a government. And how we are creating this environment for the people competing with the government that, okay, don't work for $100 or $150. If you get a job or if you're qualified, while you're very much more effective than you're working for the UN, but we are going to pay you $1,000 or $2,000, and you're basically better off. And how would you kind of avoid that after 2014 when you withdraw? Because with the withdrawal of the NATO forces, there's going to be a lot of drawdown in the NGOs and also a lot of grants that are going to be cut off from the State Department. And how are we going to kind of like have those people who are going to be unemployed back inserted to the government? Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Shoji Motoka. I'm visiting fellow of Johns Hopkins SAIS, and also I'm former Kabul bureau chief of Japanese Public Broadcast. And I got questions for maybe this is for the Cassie. The State Department is now leading the plan, the new Silk Road, which is kind of the regional economic integration, which could help on your rehabilitation of Afghanistan. So what is the benefit, good point of this plan? Also, what is the challenge you're going to face? Thank you very much.
Thank you, and we'll have the gentleman right behind you.
Hi there, and thank you. This has been a very informative presentation. I'm a grad student at Georgetown, And to piggyback on your point, sir, I've read that part of the reason that there's such a substantial force in the Afghan army after U.S. withdrawal is, excuse me, is partly because of employment. It builds skills. It occupies young men who otherwise can be a little bit problematic. So as the U.S. as the years go by and the forces are downgraded, if this is the case, what amount of funding is going to be freed up by that transition for other projects, development projects? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take this gentleman here. Oh, sorry, one and then two.
Yes, I'm Dr. Nisar Chaudhry with the Pakistan American League. It was good to really listen to Mr. Skinner's very optimistic notes, and at the same time from Catherine Campbell. I mean, all the remarks she gave and everybody else, nobody is certain about the future of Afghanistan. Nobody can say this is the picture which will develop. You should understand that Afghanis have their own history and culture, and they always fight. If they don't fight with the people from outside, then they start fighting with each other. And when the Soviets left, they never stopped fighting after achieving the objective. I think the stability of Pakistan and Afghanistan is interdependence. And fortunately, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was there recently, and there had been good developments. Because Haqqani Group, Pakistan has been asked to work or negotiate or open up line with their representatives. And Haqqani Group has put a condition that they would like to include Quetta Shura with it. They cannot unilaterally negotiate. And Quetta Shura has started generating signals that they are willing to go for the education of women. So these are positive developments. But the solution of the problem will not be a war at all. It has to be a political solution. It has to be politics of incorporation, incorporating those people, disarming those people who are fighting. Because they should get the right message. In Kabul, there is a civil society, and they have their good reasons. But in the periphery, the people still, it's a tribal society, and it had been a tribal society since centuries. To transform a tribal society into a civil society, it could take decades and decades. And the real solution has to be constant and consistent involvement and working with the people of Afghanistan. And to bring this thing to a closure through a political solution by incorporating those who are armed and dangerous in any way until they come back into the mainstream. And I think for that matter, both countries, USA as well as Afghan government, has taken certain initiatives, and let's hope and pray for the best so that Afghan becomes a country, as you said, it's a beautiful country. It's worth living, and there's a stability and peace. Everybody wants it. And even the Afghanis are tired of this fighting. Even the Taliban are tired of this fighting. And everybody is tired of this fighting. Everybody is really stuck in this war. Whether it's Pakistan, whether it's NATO, whether it's USA, whether it's Taliban. And the time is right and ripe to take this kind of initiative where these dialogues can be initiated. And that will be very helpful.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, and this gentleman over here.
Bob Hershey, I'm a consultant. To what extent is the Internet being used to try and get more transparency in this, to make decisions on how money is spent and how funding is collected from local sources toward these objectives so that everybody can see what's happening and be satisfied with it?
Okay, why don't we take two more and then give you a chance to kind of wrap things up. We'll take this gentleman here in the back. Anybody else?
This question is not particularly directed towards anybody specific.
Yourself? Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Danish Majid. I'm from Islamic Relief USA. All of you have mentioned that there needs to be a certain increase towards a trajectory in Afghanistan with particular programs, infrastructure. And you guys mentioned Somalia, too. And through Islamic Relief, we've had a few restrictions through OFAC in operating in Western Somalia and even in territories that weren't necessarily controlled by al-Shabaab. Even with this 10th anniversary that's already approached, does OFAC still play any role in determining any decisions regarding increase in funding?
Thank you. And we're right here.
Hi, Kate Phillips-Brasso with the International Rescue Committee. My question is a little bit of, on the resources, but also in the current climate and context we find ourselves here in Washington and what that means for the way forward. We're seeing a decline in resources, right, as we're going to see a decline in resources across the board for everything just because of the current financial situation and the debates in Congress. I'm wondering if, you know, going forward, if there's a way to capture this really critical moment where there still is a tension in Afghanistan and there are resources, whether it's through channeling more things through trust funds or whatnot, so that we can capture that attention and hopefully combine it with the thinking and have money and thinking at the same time. Because I take your point, David, you quoted a very salient message in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report, is that we've been pushing development timelines at totally unreasonable pace and expecting to see outcomes in just short, short intervals, along which we're just setting ourselves up for failure. So, Kath, is there a way that we could see less maybe bilateral direct assistance and more concentrated through things like the ARTF so that we can fund ministries to strengthen ministries, have a decent amount of resources along a timeline where we can expect to actually see realistic, sustainable results?
Thank you. Now, the last one will be the gentleman in the very back, and then I'll give you all a chance to respond.
I'm Brian Jolkovsky from Mercy Corps. Just quickly before I ask my question, to the issues of what NGOs in that debate are in Afghanistan. In terms of the costs and the amount of resources that are repatriated, it's important to distinguish among the different organizations that are considered NGOs. You know, in the current debate in Afghanistan, everybody seems to be lumped together, and there's a vast difference between, say, the UN and their pay scales and resources, private contractors, for-profit development agencies, international NGOs, and in fact Afghan NGOs, and all the different actors that are involved in this. So in that debate, it's important to look at those details when one discusses this. In terms of my question, success and sustainability in Afghanistan is going to be dependent on the ability to transition and the capacity of the Afghan government to actually assume its responsibilities. And I'm curious, Kath, if you could talk about how the U.S. government and AID are approaching that major challenge. You've referenced it, but maybe if you could go into a little more detail. David, maybe from the NGO perspective, how you work and build capacity in your programs. And then Caroline, kind of looking from your perspective at the military transition and the political transition, what you're seeing in terms of developments in terms of the Afghan government and its ability to assume some of those responsibilities.
Thank you very much. A variety of questions here, including the impact of jobs, regional economic integration, how much money to be saved from the drawdown, prospects for a political solution, use of the internet, possibility of using other alternatives such as trust funds, the capacity of the Afghan government, and so on. Why don't we start with you, David?
Sure. I think the first point is, I think it's important to do all we can to be optimistic about Afghanistan. Picking up some of your points, I am optimistic about Afghanistan. I don't underestimate the difficulties that are facing Afghanistan, but I think Afghanistan is has strong communities, resilient communities, and I think that it is possible to map a success for Afghanistan over the next 5, 10, 15 years. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult, but if we don't try and imagine success, it's not going to happen. And I think that it's very, very important that we do imagine success in Afghanistan and that those of us who are working on Afghanistan try and all the time be optimistic. I think that there are some very real challenges, and I think actually distortion in the salary market is a very real one. Every month I lose staff to UN organizations, to the US government, and to other agencies who are able to pay far more than international NGOs. I lose staff to I actually do staff to ministries where staff are getting salary supplements as well. So, I mean, there are many civil servants who are kept in the ministries because of salary supplements. But you're right. I mean, the salary structures in Afghanistan are nuts. They're all over the place. And one of the things that is going to be quite difficult as the transition happens is the realignment of salary structures so that they work on an equitable basis and that things work appropriately. So I think that's very important. I mean, in terms of what we're doing in order to build capacity, I think that works at three levels. The first is that I think that the work that we, along with everybody else, is doing in terms of education generally is building capacity in Afghanistan. And I would argue that that is the second most sustainable thing that any of us are doing. The first most sustainable thing is ensuring that children live beyond the age of five, because then they're going to live for 40, 50 years, and that's a pretty good sustainability. And then getting education, because once children are educated, that stays in the economy, that stays in Afghanistan, and I think education is a really important part of sustainability. First point. Second, we do a lot of work with national NGOs to build their capacity. It's something that we take a very real responsibility for. And so when we are working with national NGOs, we're supporting them on their finance, on their HR, on their programmatic expertise, on their ability to raise funds, actually. So we work with national NGOs to support them to raise funds from international donors and so on, which I think is an important part of what we're doing. And then thirdly, as I've alluded to before, many of the staff who work in Save the Children go on to work elsewhere. And actually, if you look at the cabinet in Afghanistan, if you look at the ministers in Afghanistan, almost all of them, or very many of them, have had some experience in NGOs in the past. And I think that's quite an interesting point in terms of capacity. I'll finish just on the internet, actually. In internet penetration rates in Afghanistan are 4%. So the internet is very significant and an increasingly significant part of communication amongst the urban elite, if you like, in Afghanistan. But it is still very much a minority activity. But you're right. There's in terms of building up civil society's ability to hold the Afghan government to account, the internet is going to be an extremely powerful tool. But it is, at the moment, one confined to the urban elite in Afghanistan. And so in terms of getting political, an inclusive political holding to account of Afghan institutions across the country, there's going to have to be other mechanisms to doing that. Those are going to be the kinds of mechanisms we're using elsewhere in terms of community monitoring of projects and community understanding of government, local government budgets and so on, which are not going to be able to be done through the internet. That's going to have to be done through other mechanisms. But it's an extremely important issue.
Thank you. Kath, would you like to jump in?
Just to follow up on that, I think that's right. I mean, the internet has a role, interestingly, and I'm not very conversant with these issues, but I understand that mobile phone technology is being upgraded almost as we speak, that will allow a lot more data transmission over the phone, so that 50% of the population that is already using phones will then have much better access. And I should say that 85% of the population is actually within range of cell phone technology. So it has a lot of potential. But I think it's going to take some time, and we'll see how the phones are. New Silk Road. I think Caroline mentioned that it's a vision sort of regional integration that obviously has Afghanistan an important place in there. And I think the idea for the idea is that Afghanistan really needs, one, it's landlocked, so it needs to trade in order to get its products anywhere. And that it also, we also, as Caroline mentioned, the region has to buy into Afghanistan's stability as well. We can't have regional spoilers, if you will. And so this is, I think the idea is that this is really, this is how this region could really work together to the benefit of all the countries. There are loads of challenges. I mean, some of the projects that are put out there as possibilities have been tried for many years, you know, have fits and starts. Others are almost complete. The Ring Road is 85% completed. So, you know, and I think the remaining 15% or whatever it is funded, essentially. So it will happen. There's a lot of ideas out there, but the general idea is that this is a region that needs to be better integrated. It needs to be better integrated for Afghanistan's sake, and it needs to be better integrated for the benefit of all the countries in the region. Money will be one of the big challenges, but trade barriers are another. And, you know, political reforms, economic reforms in Afghanistan and in surrounding countries are others. So there's a lot of work to be done. But I think the idea is that there's, you know, there is a vision out there. And I agree with David. We've got to, you know, you've got to have a realistic, but you've got to try and always be thinking about what is the possible. Kate asked about how can we capture money now for later. You know, the U.S. government made a commitment last year to put 50% of our money on budget. And we are trying, I mean, that was one of the points I was trying to make, is really trying to think about how can we increase the use of local systems, the money that we put in. You know, how can we either give it directly to the Afghan government or give it to the ARTF? Obviously, there are lots of concerns about accountability, though I've just heard about a World Bank report recently that said, you know, there's no more concerns on corruption going through local systems or through the Afghan government than there are going through any other system. So that was an interesting finding. You know, I think the ARTF is a reasonably good mechanism, and we are committed to reaching that 50%. And now that the Kabul Bank issue and hopefully the IMF deal is going to be agreed upon, you know, we'll probably get a little bit more back on track on that, and I think other donors as well. So hopefully that is one way to do it. There's also a question about, you know, what is the U.S. trying to do in terms of building the capacity of the government to take on its responsibilities? And I think part of that is literally capacity building of government ministries, you know, supporting the Ministry of Mines so that they can better manage, et cetera, the exploitation of the natural resources, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, et cetera, putting money through those ministries or through into the ARTF to be used how the government of Afghanistan determines, I think, is another important way. And another way is really figuring out and working with the Afghan government to figure out how they can increase their revenue so that they can step up to the other big challenge, which is them eventually funding a lot of these activities, these services, the ongoing maintenance, operations and maintenance of infrastructure. And so, you know, a lot of our activities, you know, we have spent money on power, on electricity, and it really wasn't just so that David would have lights outside his office, though that is part of it. But, you know, the stable power sources is a key need for private investment. The businesses can't operate if the power goes off four times a day or, you know, erratically. So, you know, there's a pretty clear correlation between the availability of power and economic growth. So, you know, we're trying to think about these things as well. And I think trying to support the Afghan government is they're trying to figure out how do they increase their revenue, whether it's through customs or taxes, et cetera. And there are all sorts of U.S. government agencies working with different parts of the Afghan government to explore those things.
Yeah.
Okay, Caroline, last word.
Well, we're over our time, but I'll just quickly say that in terms of the political settlement, political transition, I mean, my sense is that the current political system is actually fundamentally flawed, driving grievances for the insurgency, but then also creating deep disillusion even within the loyal opposition. And, I mean, talking to people in Afghanistan, there just seems like there's a legitimacy crisis at hand, and that if you're serious about a political strategy in Afghanistan, you're thinking about the political settlement and discussions with insurgents and discussions internally, but you're also simultaneously thinking about political reform to deal with basically a system that was set up in Bonn that is over-centralized. There's no accountability, no checks and balances. There's no ability to actually, there's no access for people to channel their grievances, their interests into the political system. It's just so top-down. In a system that's not, I mean, with a political history that's not, that doesn't match. So, I mean, and the administration and I think the international community has not figured out how to effectively leverage its, to use its leverage to sort of push forward both the political reform agenda and the political settlement. They seem to be doing the political settlement more. That may be able to start driving a political reform process, but the political reform process has been largely off the map. So, again, I'm hoping that that's where the administration is going, recognizing that the current strategy is not going to lead us anywhere. But we're not seeing right now, at least by the Karzai government, despite commitments made at Kabul conference and other forums, a desire to push through some of the political changes that I think most people would recognize probably need to occur for the system to be more sustainable, inclusive, accountable.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for coming, and especially to our panelists for their observations.